Infendo Radio is on now.
Welcome to Infendo Radio, the best Nintendo podcast on the English-speaking internet. I'm your host, Holly Felmuth. This is episode 319. Those were a little out of order. Joining me tonight, we have Lewis Pugh.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, that threw me for a loop there for a minute. It's weird to introduce Lewis as opposed to being introduced by him. So that was a little strange. But tonight, unfortunately, Harrison and Colin couldn't join us for various reasons. But, you know, two-man show. And also actually a two-part show. Tonight we're doing a smaller structure. We're skipping what we've been playing. Although technically a little later on, I will definitely be talking about what I've been playing. So we'll get that in there. But tonight's show is basically just going to consist of part one, Nintendo news, and part two, community comments and questions. So let's just dive right into this. The first Nintendo news piece that I have listed here is that Link-inspired armor and weapons have been confirmed for Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate for the 3DS, and there's actually more special equipment on the way. So Capcom put out a trailer for this to kind of confirm that it was happening. I guess it was kind of rumored before, and so now it's definitely confirmed. And the trailer basically just shows two characters, one male, one female, dressed as Link with Link's hair and everything. It's pretty snazzy. One of them wields the Master Sword, and one of them wields the... And I had to get clarification for this. Thank you for that, Mike. But the other is wielding the fully upgraded Sacred Sword from... Or Sacred Bow, sorry, from Skyward Sword. So those are the, you know, kind of two new weapons. And also, I think there's some, like, Hylian shield throwing in this trailer. And so that's pretty cool, too. Lewis, did you get a chance to see it?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, I've got a chance to see this one. And I'm pleasantly surprised that they are actually putting it onto the Ultimate Edition, because it's the version that we're getting, for one. And I hope they kind of use this to promote it over here. I reckon just, you know, slapping on some of these Zelda-themed items could, you know, boost some sales. And personally, I think it looks quite fitting to see, like, a Link-costumed warrior run around in that universe. It doesn't seem completely out of place. So, yeah, I really like it.
Actually, it did seem a little out of place to me when I first watched the trailer. I thought, I don't know, because Link is a pretty, you know, like, agile character. The way he moves in Zelda games is, you know, a lot more quick than in Monster Hunter games, and so to see them dressed as Link and moving around kind of sluggishly compared to Link and does in Zelda games, that was a little weird at first, but after, you know, like, watching it the second time, I thought, I'm used to it, and I really can't wait to play this game and play as Link in this game, so I'm happy about it. So any predictions as to what the other special equipment could be?
That's a very good point. I mean, they might try and do something with one of the new weapons that they're introducing into Monster Hunter. I'm not sure quite how they'll make that mix into the Zelda universe, but I reckon they'll try and do something there. But yeah, I mean, talking about how it fits or it doesn't fit, it's interesting how kind of Nintendo's relaxed on doing these sorts of things with their partners. Because obviously last year we had examples where you could have, like, Mario and Luigi, like, skins in Rayman. And I guess in the sense that they're both platforming games, it made some sense. But it was quite just, you know, hilarious just to see Rayman and Globox dress up as those characters, because they just looked like they were, the actual costume sizes didn't fit them, literally. And it was quite funny to watch. So, yeah, the fact that it kind of looks like Link, even though it's just a costume of him. And so, yeah, there are going to be those classes where he looks, animation-wise, looks a bit slow and so on. I still think it's a cool fit, though.
And I think you're right about the fact that I think it will appeal to Western audiences as well. In fact, I have a friend, and in case he's listening to this, you know who you are, but he is not, well, he tried Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate for the Wii U, I believe, and just, you know, kind of right away thought, like, I don't think this is really my cup of tea. So I kind of hope this is one of those things that kind of, because he's a huge Nintendo fan, I think that maybe this will help him to reconsider his thoughts on Monster Hunter. So, yeah, hopefully that does do something good for the series. It's a fantastic series. Not everyone's cup of tea, as my friend has demonstrated, but I think most people could enjoy it if they just give it a chance. That's all it takes. Just give it a chance. Maybe two or three chances.
Yeah, maybe a long out, you know, long set of hours worth of chances. But yeah, as soon as you kind of get the game, it really can grab a lot of people. Again, it's not for everyone, but I think there's a lot of the market over here who aren't playing the game yet who would really love it if they kind of realized what it actually was.
My brother, he won't, you know, really give it a second thought because he thinks the combat just looks way too slow. And I think that's how most people are. Like, the combat is really, you know, like, slow and deliberate. But that actually becomes a really, like, a shining spot in the whole game, in the whole experience, basically, to me anyway. So, yeah, later on. Actually, it's early 2015, isn't it? Early 2015, yeah. I think that'll be a very excellent game for everyone to consider getting. But moving on to, you know, like, different types of games, we have a little news story here that a Paper Mario stage is going to be in Super Smash Bros. 3DS. Just the 3DS version, because the stages are mostly different between the two. And it's kind of small, but, you know, it's the first Paper Mario stage that there's ever been. And I feel like that's actually kind of long overdue. I mean, Paper Mario's been around since the N64 days, and so it'll probably be a fun and cool stage, even if the Paper Mario series, as of late, hasn't been performing all that well. But I'll just skip on over to the next news story. There's a Nintendo Direct coming. Those are always extremely exciting. This one will focus on Hyrule Warriors. It'll be Monday, August 4th, starting at 8 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. Which, I mean, what time is that for you, Lewis?
Oh, you put me on the spot here. Oh, I'm not great on my time zones.
So that's 9 o'clock for me, and I think you're like 7 hours ahead of me, which would put it at like
2 a.m.
Yeah,
that does sound about right from what I heard. This is going to be a very peculiarly timed direct over here.
And, you know, people in Europe, you can tune into the broadcast at the time that Nintendo of America is broadcasting it, but Nintendo of Europe will also be, you know, kind of broadcasting it as well. I don't know if it'll be the exact same video or just, you know, a Europe specific one, but it'll be at the slightly less crazy time of, I think, like 5 o'clock a.m. CEST, which I don't know what that is, but I read it somewhere. Do you know what that is, Lewis?
Oh, no, I think.
Yeah, we're pretty horrible with our time zones here, apparently. I should look that up, but I'm sure that you can figure it out. So that's exciting. Hyrule Warriors is looking more and more appealing to me as more and more people try to convince me to buy it, basically. So I'm excited to hear more about the game. Certainly some new characters will be revealed as playable, but is there anything else that you think might make it into the Nintendo Direct?
I think there's going to be a big focus around different characters, and we'll probably get some new characters unveiled. I mean, we may hear about just, I guess, additional modes. I think we've only really heard about the kind of the campaign mode about in the game itself. So they might tell us some more just general different features that the game has. But yeah, I think a big focus is going to be on new character reveals. And I'm almost a bit worried that they're going to go full overboard like they did for the Mario Kart 8 Direct. And saying that, I mean, with similar like game-specific Nintendo Directs before the game comes out, they kind of pretty much tell you almost everything the game has to offer, including a lot of the unlockable stuff. So we may find out all the characters, is my suspicion.
So people have been talking, I don't know much about the Warrior series, but I think I was reading a little conversation between Colin and one of our readers, Risen Devil, I believe, and they were just talking back and forth about what they know, which is a lot more than I know, about the Warriors series. And they said that another crossover with the Warriors series, another game that crossed over, had like 30 playable characters. And for a Warriors game, that's actually a pretty small amount of playable characters.
That's from what I hear as
well,
yeah.
I mean, currently, yeah. So currently we have like 10 characters announced for Hyrule Warriors total, which it's interesting to note that two of those are male and like 8 are female, so this is just, to me, a really weird roster of playable characters so far. And for all I know, in the Nintendo Direct, we're going to get, like, you know, maybe 4 or 5 more new characters I don't know. It seems like if the other Warriors series have that many playable characters, we'd get a lot of playable characters announced.
That's right, yeah. I don't think it'll be quite as many as what's normal for the series, but considering how high the numbers usually are, it'll probably be quite a lot of playable Zelda characters in itself. So you know, I'm looking forward to seeing kind of where they go to pick these characters from. Are they gonna, you know, stick to Ocarina of Time, Twilight Princess, and Skyward Sword? Yeah, are those kind of like locked the three games that this game takes inspiration from, or will they go a bit further? That would be interesting to see as well. I'm kind of happy either way. I mean, there's lots of characters they can plunge from either way.
They're putting Tingle in.
Oh yeah,
It's happening.
I wouldn't be surprised if he's in there. Or maybe he has his own mode or something. But yeah, I reckon he'll make some sort of appearance.
Oh, most certainly some sort of appearance. And I think you once mentioned that Fierce Deity Link
Yes,
should be in here. I mean,
that
how
would
can he
just make
not?
so much. I mean, it
So.
would almost make sense if he was the only playable character in this. From like playing the actual Zelda games, when you transform into the first DT Link, it is kind of that crazy combat feel, which is kind of what this is going for. So yeah, if they don't take that opportunity up, I'll be very surprised.
I'm kind of ashamed to say it, but I've never played Majora's Mask all the way through.
It's definitely worth it. It's a very bizarre game, which is good for the series. It doesn't feel like all the other games, which is awesome.
That's what people are kind of hoping for, you know, Zelda for Wii U, but oh my goodness,
It
that's a discussion for another time. I should have mentioned this along with the other Monster Hunter news that we had, but there will not be a region lock between Europe and North America in Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. And at first, I didn't realize why this was a big deal because, you know, I've played with you, Lewis,
Yeah.
on Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate on the Wii U. I thought, why is this a big deal? But apparently, the last Monster Hunter game that was exclusively made for a handheld, I think it was maybe the PS Vita. Colin was explaining this all to me. It didn't, or it had a region lock, and so this is actually kind of a big deal. And, you know, it's nothing but good news. I can't wait to play with, you know, everyone overseas and here in the United States and everywhere, except for Japan, apparently. That's another thing, is that there is a region lock between Japan and North America and Europe. So those are the details there. But moving on, our last two pieces of news here are the ones that I really actually wanted to get to. The first of those two that is to me very exciting is that Retro Redux has debuted. I kind of just came up with this little project where I'm going to play a bunch of NES games because I basically missed out on that time period. And I have called it Retro Redux. The NES like phase, I guess you could say, is called NES Quest. And the first post basically just explains what it's all about. I'm just going to play as many NES games as I can. And just so the readers and the listeners also have some chances to influence the whole thing, there's going to be, you know, voting for which games that I play, basically. So right now, currently, there are four games up, you know, for you to vote on, and you can only vote on one, technically. Those games are Faxanadu, and if I pronounce that wrong, I'm sorry. That's just how I've been pronouncing it. I never even had heard of this game till, you know, a few days ago. The next one is Star Tropics, Paperboy, and DuckTales. So those are the, you know, like four games. I currently actually am waiting for Faxanadu and Star Tropics to come in the mail because I, you know, read up on those games and thought, I want to play those. So I'm waiting for those. Paperboy, I don't own in any form and haven't like ordered it or anything, but I would, you know, if it got enough votes. I already do own DuckTales, like an original NES card of that though. So currently DuckTales is actually winning by a landslide. So everyone, you know, if you don't want me to start out this whole thing with DuckTales, go to infindo.com and find the post. It shouldn't be too hard to find. Or even, you know, underneath the posts with the podcast, you can vote on one of those other three if you're really strong about that. I think Star Tropics is in second place. So if you really want me to play Star Tropics, go vote on it. Lewis, you haven't really voted, and I haven't really clarified that you
Yeah,
guys are
no.
allowed to, but I don't know. Which game would you want me to start
Oh,
on?
it's such an interesting question. I mean, I might even join you along on this quest, because I think the two most interesting titles on this, on which you've just listed out, I've not played myself. I've not played either Star Tropics or, and this is my assumption of the pronunciation. I could be as wrong or whatever, but Faxanadu.
That actually sounds better than what I got.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's right or not, but that's what comes to mind. I've not played either, but I've heard good things about both. I have played DuckTales and Paperboy.
Paperboy was one I had never even heard of.
Oh, really? I've only really played it in, I guess, small bursts, but it's, at least my assumption, it's just that type of arcadey type game. I'm not sure if there's more to it than that. I am curious, though, is this like a virtual console thing, or is it actual physical cartridges you're getting hold of?
That is actually a very good question. I have kind of laid down these like ground rules for this, and the first rule is that I have to try to replicate the experience of playing the original game like as closely as possible. So if I can, you know, like cheaply acquire an original NES cartridge, I should probably do that. But playing games on the virtual console on either the Wii U or the 3DS isn't out of the question. I just have to, I mean, if I were playing an NES game on my Wii or Wii U, playing with like a Wii remote by itself would probably be, you know, as close as I could get. And so basically, I don't know, it's just a general rule. I just need to replicate the original experience as closely as possible.
Virtual console's a pretty good bet, if, you know, assuming that the get the titles on the system. But just because kind of the quality of the emulation is just so close to the original games, because they kind of stuck by the rules that, you know, they're not actually going to be changing anything to them, and they very slowly brought one out after another, they do pretty much match up very well compared to a lot of other services out there. And, yeah, you mean you got quite good controller support as well. As you said, you got the Wii Remote controller turned sideways, but you've also just got that classic controller, which pretty much adopts all the systems pretty well.
Or, you know, if it's on the Wii U, there's the gamepad, which works all right.
It's got all the buttons you need there.
But I do have an NES, and so I do plan on getting as many as I can. Actual carts. I need to expand my collection of NES games anyway, because before I ordered, oh my gosh, what was your pronunciation?
Faxanadu, that's what I said.
Faxanadu.
I like how we're saying this as fact here, but we could be just going down a completely weird rabbit hole.
So besides, or before I ordered Faxanadu and Star Tropics, all I owned were four NES carts. Technically five games, because one of them is DuckTales plus, Duck Hunt, sorry, Duck Hunt plus Super Mario Bros. Then I had like Tetris, which is also super common, and DuckTales and Dragon Warrior. That was like all of my NES games. I've only started like collecting them fairly recently, and so I don't have a huge collection. So that's another thing I want to do, is just expand. So that's good. But you still haven't told me what you would vote on.
Yeah, I managed to avoid it, didn't I? I would go, I mean, I've not played it myself, but Star Tropics, just because I've heard the most favourable things about that game. So I would be interested to hear what your opinions were on it.
Yeah, I'm like you. I've also heard very many and very good things about Star Tropics, but I don't know much about it. So I'm excited to play either DuckTales or, I mean, I feel like Faxanadu and Paperboy are kind of out of the running at this point. So I'm basically just saying that I'm excited to play either Star Tropics or DuckTales. Most likely DuckTales, but we'll see. Things could change. So that's that. I mean, this is probably going to be a very ongoing thing. And it's like Lewis has said, if anyone wants to participate like along with me, feel free to do that. I mean, I'm just going to, you know, like log everything when I can, like as soon as I know which game has won the vote, which I should probably come up with an end time. We'll just say Thursday, this upcoming Thursday. Let me look at a date here. Okay, Thursday, August 7th will be the last day of voting for everyone. And then Friday, I will have decided and acquired, hopefully, or already have, the game that I will be playing. So everyone go and vote on that. And yeah, play along with me if you really want to. I think this is going to be so much fun. And so everyone should participate if you can.
And it's a cool project. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, when, you know, I was born in 91. I'm not going to lie about my age. And so, you know, I pretty much missed out on the entire revolution of the NES. So this should be really fun for me, I think.
And actually, without going too far, moving kind of about what we're going to discuss next, it's part of the reason why I don't really have a kind of a huge history of NES games, because the NES over here in the UK and Europe wasn't as such a big thing as it was in America. And so there's a lot of kind of assumed game knowledge which I don't have from that era, just because I was like on the PC era at the time. So yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in this, and yeah, and I probably will join you to kind of expand my my old Nintendo.
Knowledge base.
Yeah, my kind of retro Nintendo knowledge base.
That's one of the things I hope to do as well. Actually, that whole thing, in Europe, how the NES wasn't as big there as it was in America, that was touched on a little bit in a little book that came out recently. Little book, it's actually quite a massive book. It's called Console Wars by Blake J. Harris. And that is our last, I'm putting news in quotes here. I'm doing the quote thing with my fingers. Our last news story is basically our little discussion about console wars. I took like probably almost a month to read that book. Lewis here has finished it in less than a week, so that's very impressive. So we both finished the book, and just to start off, Lewis, what are your overall impressions of the book itself?
I firstly want to say I'm a filthy cheater. I listened to most of the book on an audio book. That's how I managed the impressive feat of consuming it within the week. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was surprised how much kind of a dramatization it was. I thought it was going to be very kind of factual based, but it follows the story of Tom Clancy, who was the SEO of Sega of America, and the trials and tribulations of, I guess, of Sega and America and Japan against the big giant of Nintendo. And it was really fascinating to read slash listen to, and I learned a good deal from it about different events that happened, and it was also just very interesting to hear the opposite viewpoint to what I'm n normally considered part of, in terms of like everything was from, well, mostly from Sega's perspective, and so they were seeing Nintendo as, the big bad corporation they were fighting against, and a lot of that was for good reason, which they brought up, which is also interesting to hear about in terms of Nintendo's various like methods and schemes they had in place for exclusivity, and their different licensing agreements with both game developers and retailers, and just to kind of hold on to that monopoly that they managed to pick up.
Yeah, that actually kind of drove me crazy at first. Because it's like Lewis just said, Nintendo was kind of portrayed as the bad guy. It's a very narrative book. So it, like Lewis has said, it's very dramatized, and there's a lot of dialogue that probably didn't, happen word for
Oh
word, but
yeah.
that's the whole thing with writing a narrative is that, it's all fact-based, but just to make it interesting to read, it's got some suspense in there. You've got your big main characters, minor characters, so it's like reading a story. And so as such, there's a villain in the story, and basically Nintendo was the villain. Not always though. In a few chapters, I was very happy to read that, oh, Nintendo's doing well. Nintendo's got some good guys on their side too. Things like that. But it's like I say, some of the Sega stuff drove me crazy. So if you're like a really die-hard Nintendo fan like myself, it's still a good book to read, and obviously in the end, Nintendo, kind of comes out on top. So, so it's not too bad for a Nintendo fan to read, but some of those chapters were so hard for me to get through, hence the fact that it took me quite a long time to finish it.
So I think it's also cool just to kind of compare what Nintendo was going through back then, and I guess what Sega was going through back then, compared to the state of the industry today. There's a lot of parallels throughout it, and there's obviously a lot of differences. Obviously, Nintendo isn't or doesn't claim 90% market share of the video game industry currently, but in a way, I guess like Nintendo has some parallels to the old scrappy Sega back in the day, and it's quite bizarre just listening to some of these chapters and just hearing the just the different things Nintendo are getting up to control that market share as well.
Yeah, not only are there, parallels to what's going on in the industry today, but when you read this book, you really, really get that sense that this time period and all these things that happened changed the industry for good. And so it's actually very interesting to read in that sense as well.
Oh, definitely, and I think another important thing is it's not included in the title of the book, but it also goes quite a lot into detail about Sony's part in in the console wars itself, and the different companies who were partnering up and not partnering up, and everything which came into the launch of the PlayStation, as well as Nintendo and the Sega.
Yeah, apparently, and it mentions this in the book, and I think it used the word inadvertently. Sony inadvertently contributed to Sega's downfall. So that's an interesting thing to think about, because Sega, I feel like Sega was just coming, you know, up just as Sega was going down. Did I say Sony was going up just as Sega was going down? Oh gosh. Now I'm getting my words mixed up. So it was very interesting that, you know, Sony played such a, you know, massive role in the book, you know, when it doesn't say anything about the company
exactly.
on the cover.
I mean, it's kind of summarized up quite well, really, because what happened in real life. But yes, like, Sony just kind of came in out of nowhere, essentially. And obviously, you know, the book does give details and how that came about. But yeah, I mean, they weren't in there for long, but kind of as soon as they stepped in, they did have that that dominant role. But yeah, there's like just so many different things about this that I really thoroughly enjoyed. So I would definitely recommend this to, well, especially anyone listening to this show.
One interesting thing that goes on in the book that we haven't talked a lot about is like this, what the author describes as a civil war between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. In fact, on the back of the book, I read this a few different times. On the back of the book, it talks about, you know, like Sega was battling Nintendo in America, but, you know, the civil war that was raging between Sega of America and Sega of Japan was even like bigger and grander than the battle between Sega and Nintendo. I don't know about you, Lewis, but I was a little bit let down because on the back, you know, it makes it seem like this civil war thing between Sega of America and Sega of Japan is a like massive thing. And it didn't seem that, you know, big in the book, really. Yeah. It still just focused mostly on Nintendo versus Sega.
Sure. I guess it does pop up in some of the more kind of pivotal issues of the story, including the creation of Sonic, where there's a lot of back and forth between Sega of America and Japan on how the character design should be for Sonic. And I guess, although that doesn't take up a huge duration of the story, its importance is obvious.
Apparently Sega of Japan was, I don't know, irritating, what's his name, Naka, something Naka, Yuji? Yuji Naka, the guy who basically created Sonic, the video game. The creator was a little bit, you know, impatient with Sega of Japan, and so in order to try and keep him on board, Sega of America said, hey, you can come over to America and have more creative freedom, and so on and so forth. So he actually moved to America to, you know, make later Sonic games after the first one. So that was very interesting. But, you know, that all just kind of contributes to the reason why you should probably just pick this book up and read it yourself. So, but we do have some, you know, like comments from listeners about the book a little bit. Mike McSurdy doesn't ask a question specifically about the book, but I'll let you find out when I just read this. He asks, if you were to write a book on a particular era, event, or history of video games, what would you write about and why? So, you know, in the spirit of writing this, you know, what they call a business thriller based on the war between Sony and Nintendo, or Sega and Nintendo, like what would we choose to write our book on? If we were to write a book on something like this, what would we choose for it to be? Lewis, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I've been given this question some thought, and if I had, you know, the extensive resources and time to put into a similar project to Console Wars, I think I would aim a bit more modern. There's a couple of great books which kind of focus on the initial areas of the video game industry, and obviously that's absolutely fantastic. So I think I'll take the opposite route and do something more modern. But I think it would be interesting to hear, in a similar vein, kind of the cross between the late GameCube into Wii, and essentially from Wii to the launch and like the first year or so of the Wii U, and just hear what was happening on, you know, the other end of the fence, as it were, on just Nintendo of Japan side, how they were collecting feedback, how R&D was going, and what kind of business decisions drove them to go from the GameCube to the Nintendo Wii, just because there's such drastic differences in approaches, and how like set in stone the Wii's design was. I'm sure there was some incredibly interesting stories behind the scenes which came to that decision, and I bet there was like some other like more advanced prototypes which were more similar to the rival systems, and they really put all their bets on this lower powered motion controlled system in the end. But yeah, I think that would be cool, and it would be interesting also finding out again their decision to transform that into the Wii U again, which is another very different type of console, and obviously their place in the industry is incredibly different to what we were discussing in Console Wars. And so yeah, what drove them to those decisions to use this very unique system? And yeah, it would be incredibly interesting to find out how they came across to those decisions.
Yeah, going the modern route would be very interesting. I think most people are probably curious as to what led Nintendo from going to the Wii to the Wii U. Especially now, because the Wii U was nothing like the success that the Wii was. And so I think, most people are kind of wondering, maybe they don't wonder this like every day, or maybe they don't, really give much effort into thinking about this, I guess. But I think that everyone somewhere deep down is wondering like how that transition between the Wii and the Wii U happened, just because of the Wii U kind of suffering at the moment. But my thought, I was thinking about this, there's actually kind of multiple things that I would be interested in learning about, because I'm not super knowledgeable, or there's some things I'm not super knowledgeable about and that I would like to learn about. So if I were to write a book on that, obviously I'd become super knowledgeable about it. But one of the things that came to my mind as I was thinking about this is, it's not like a particular era or event or history. It's just kind of a look at video games and women, like their appeal or non-appeal in some cases to women. That just, I don't know why, kind of interests me. I think that I was reading a little bit about, I think maybe this is why I'm thinking about this, but I was reading a little bit about Pac-Man and how that game actually did a lot toward making video games appeal to women. So I just kind of thought, like, that'd be an interesting thing to look at. Like, how did that whole situation work out, and how are video games appealing to women today, and so on and so forth. But another thing that kind of interests me is the GameCube. I was still pretty young when the GameCube was, starting out and through its lifespan, and I didn't get a GameCube until way into its lifespan because I'm a little poor girl and didn't really have a lot of chances, but I wanted one so bad, and I eventually did get one and played tons of Melee on it, of course. But one thing that interests me is the transition from the N64 to the GameCube, because I think the N64 was pretty dang popular. And then Nintendo moves from that to the GameCube, which I don't think had the same popularity. And I would want to learn about how, like Xbox came into the picture and things like that. And yeah, I don't know. That's the thing. I don't know. I don't know a lot about certain things. And so I'd love to learn about them. And if I did have the time and resources to write a book, that would be a whole lot of fun as well. Our next question relates directly to console wars, though. Mike Fulham asks, what was Sega's biggest downfall, leading to them finally getting out of the hardware business, especially with a great, underappreciated console like the Sega Dreamcast? And he has another question here. Were there any people working inside the two companies who went to work for the other? So there's kind of two separate questions here. So I don't know if this is going to get into like console wars spoiler territory or anything, but this first question, I think basically Mike is trying to, or is asking, what was like the biggest thing that led to Sega's downfall, basically. So I don't know. Lewis, what did you think that happened in console wars was kind of the biggest factor?
Well, yeah, the story throughout is kind of Sega of America building up Sega's representation and how many units they were selling in America itself. So obviously at the very beginning of the story, compared against Nintendo. They weren't popular at all. I think they discussed that Nintendo had 90% of the market and the rest were fighting for the other 10. I guess Sega was a part of that. But during the end of the Genesis's life cycle in America, they had over 50%. So they managed to claim it from Nintendo.
Yeah, that was like their peak,
Exactly.
I would say.
And so kind of the story ends kind of when the Nintendo 64 is almost out, or if it's coming out next year technically, but the PlayStation just launches and Sega launches the Sega Saturn. And it's actually a bit before this where Tom Clancy is feeling a bit down on the company that he's leading. And it's one of the reasons is because they are unfocused, and they're launching a lot of different peripherals or consoles in themselves, or at least that they're in development and working on things which he doesn't necessarily feel confident in. So things like the 32X and the Sega CD, and he's doesn't feel 100% about what the Saturn's going to be. And so it sounds like that Sega really spread themselves thin. They kind of they got really popular, I mean, especially in America. And I think they went a bit overboard with what they were trying to do instead of focusing on doing any particular thing really well. And so I think, well, as we know, a similar pattern continued after these events. There were a lot more Sega consoles. So yeah, I think that was the main problem, that they didn't really put all their eggs in one basket and just really focus on one particular console. They did have these weird unsupported machines and jump from one to the other.
They also had a lot of side projects like Sega Channel, which I think was going to be like a TV network,
That's true, yeah.
basically.
Yeah, they did put a lot of effort into that, and that's mentioned in the book as well. But yeah, I think that's kind of the main reason of Sega's fallings, as it were. Because it seems on like on the software side, they were, well, they were getting a lot better, but I guess compared to their competition, that wasn't their strongest advantage, as it was the actual the games that they had themselves. But yeah, no, I guess that is. It's just being a bit unfocused, yeah, and just doing lots of different things across different platforms.
Yeah, it's interesting because the book doesn't even reach time period when the Sega Dreamcast
No.
came out even. I think what's his last, how do you say his last name? Tom
Kalansky?
Kalinske. Okay, I thought it was like Kalinske
Or
or I don't know.
possibly.
Whatever. So Tom, I think he actually left Sega around 1999, or no, not 1999. That would have been like past the Sega Dreamcast, its launch anyway. He left in 96, I think. And this story was based mostly on his, I mean, he was like the hero, the main character and hero of the story. And so I don't think he was about to go past that. So that's something that kind of interests me is that the book basically ends like just as Sega is, starting its fall from grace, I feel like, because it's like I mentioned, they had over 50% market share, and that was their peak. And then it's only within like a few chapters after that that the book ends. And so, it doesn't even get into that. But I would say, as far as this question goes, like, what was the biggest thing that led them to finally get out of the hardware business? I definitely, well, I agree with Lewis, but I also think that that main topic of the civil war between Sega of America and Sega of Japan probably was the biggest thing, because the way it describes it, it really was, a really tense thing. And the CEO of Sega of Japan, he kind of went crazy at the end, didn't he? I mean, he went in and was looking at some of the stuff that the hardware developers, I guess, were coming up with in Japan, and he like had this freak out at one point and busted some of the stuff that they made, saying that like Tom is not gonna like this because he really liked Tom. And yeah, there was just a lot of tension within Sega of Japan and between Sega of America and Sega of Japan, so I think that was probably one of the bigger things.
Yeah, actually, I'll add something else here. I think another big reason is the extra competition from Sony, which obviously although they are a new player to video games, ironically they kind of had support from Sega previously, and they were kind of working or trying to work with Nintendo as well. But they did kind of just come out guns a-blazing, and the book does end with Sony releasing or announcing the original PlayStation for $100 less than Sega just announced for the Saturn. And so the PlayStation was both, you know, was both technically a lot more powerful system, but it also, you know, is $100 less. And I think that with a very surprising amount of software support as well for the PlayStation, I think that was Sega's downfall. They were focusing so much on trying to tackle Nintendo that when someone else also came on the block as well as them, and then things started to crumble.
Mike's second question is, this is an interesting one to me. I really actually can't wait to talk about this, but were there any people working inside the two companies who went to work for the other company? That actually, did happen at least once. This guy working for Nintendo named Bill White apparently went from Nintendo to Sega. Also, Howard Phillips, Nintendo's game master, he was like super popular in his time, mostly during the NES life cycle. He apparently left Nintendo and almost joined Sega.
Yes.
This to me was very, very interesting. Almost joined Sega. I kind of like how the book describes that actually, because it's like, I don't know. I guess he even if he left the company, even if he left Nintendo, he still felt, loyal to Nintendo to some degree, and so I liked that. But Bill White was the big one who moved from Nintendo to Sega. For sure. He definitely, got in with Sega and everything after that. Sega apparently, tried actively to s basically snipe.
To poach different Nintendo employees.
So that kind of cracked me up. This doesn't actually relate to that question, but something else that I found interesting in this book is that near the end, it's talking a lot about Donkey Kong Country because Donkey Kong Country really did a whole lot to, put some nails in Sega's coffin, as well as, make the SNES as great as it was. Apparently, an American, what was his name? Tony Harmon, I believe, was trying to get Sega or Nintendo of Japan to, stop making or stop spending money on stupid commercials and, give me a little bit of money, and I will make a great game out of this. And you will have one, he says, you'll have one less, bad commercial that you're spending money on. So he takes this money, he finds this company called Rare in Europe, I believe, like London, and they make Donkey Kong Country. And while he was, in the process of developing this game, because, apparently, Nintendo headquarters is pretty, open and social. People would stop by and be like, "Oh, so what are you working on?" and everything like that. And he got so annoyed with that that he's like, "Can I have like just a separate place of my own to work quietly in this building so that I'm not bugged by all these other Nintendo employees?" Because he wanted to, work on this secret awesome project. So they actually literally kind of built like a fort type thing within Nintendo's headquarters where he could work in peace, and they called it the Treehouse. And I think that's the origin story for today's Nintendo Treehouse, where they do all their localization here in North America. So that was a very, to me, the most interesting thing, just a little factoid, I guess, that came out of the book was that. But and on this subject of, I don't know, talking about, small little interesting facts that came out of that book, was there any cool little facts that you found interesting, Lewis?
Oh, the whole bunch of them. I mean, I think I guess briefly glossed over earlier, but some of the details in what turned into Sonic's creation, the back and forth from Sega of America and Sega of Japan, and finding out initially he was this creature with a was it like a spike leather jacket and a guitar and a busty girlfriend, and a human girlfriend, I should add. And yeah, and I guess Sega of America kind of crafted him into the Sonic that we know today. And
Which was a good thing
yeah,
for
definitely.
them at the time.
Well, at least for America and the rest of the world. I mean, never know. I mean, perhaps it would have been a lot more popular in Japan than the current design. But yeah, no, I definitely agree. It was definitely for the best.
There was a little behind the scenes thing with the Sega Scream. I never saw any of those commercials. I should probably look them up if they exist on YouTube. But Sega commercials would end in the famous, apparently it's famous, Sega Scream. And they just had this employee, well, the marketing people that Sega basically commissioned to make commercials for Sonic the Hedgehog games. They had an employee and they just brought him in. I don't think he was a big guy, a big employee or anything like that. And they just had him like scream Sega. In, you know, multiple times in multiple ways. That was very interesting to me. That's how the now famous Sega Scream came into being. So that was another interesting fact from the book. But we are going to end with our last little reader question here that doesn't have to do with console wars, but it's still a good question from a valued listener.
I think we should almost be getting sponsorship money at this point now from console wars.
It's a good book.
It is a very good book.
Nintendo fans, Sega fans, gaming fans alike should read it. And it's like we say, it's written in a narrative style that is, you know, engaging and interesting to read. Be interesting to watch the movie that they come out with this. But our final question, or, you know, there's a few comments and a couple different questions here, comes from Steve. He says, a few episodes ago, you guys talked about Shovel Knight. I played it, loved it, bought the soundtrack, and started New Game Plus. Have any of you guys had a chance to get into it? What was your favorite part of it? Mine was how it felt retro and amazing, but didn't have the technical limitations of systems past. So that's Steve. Lewis, you haven't, you know, gotten Shovel Knight, have you? I know that you guys in Europe can get it on Steam.
We can. I have downloaded it on Steam, and I have played it briefly. Although, as odd as I can be sometimes, despite the purchase, I am kind of oddly just trying to hold off on it, just because I want to play it on the Wii U.
I'd be the same way.
Yeah, so I'm just tentatively playing it. I was like, oh, I want to show some support, and, you know, I'm jumping into it. You know, it feels good still. It feels right, and it does feel like one of the classic Nintendo games.
So how far are you?
Oh, not far at all. I've only put, like, 10-20 minutes into it, tops. Just really jumping in and just getting a feel of the game.
So you've beaten the first stage, and that's it. that's, you know, it's probably like 10 minutes to beat that first stage. These stages are pretty long. So I am a little further. After I got this question, which was a couple of days ago, I decided, like, I have Shovel Knight. I should probably play it for this little selection of questions. So I've had a chance to get into it. There's my answer to that first question of whether we have had a chance to get
that's
into it.
That's the end of the show.
Yep, the end. I've played Shovel Knight. Yeah, that's that. The other part of the question, though, is what was your favorite part of it? So I'll just quickly say right now that I haven't beaten it, but I spent a very good chunk of today playing it, because yesterday I, you know, had work, didn't have a lot of chance to play it. So where am I? I'm trying to think what the last stage I completed was. The thing is, you can go back to like previous stages, and I've been doing that just to collect tons of money, so I can't seem to remember which the last stage. I think it was the Mole Knight one. Let's see, it's kind of like this lava stage where you have to use green goo to change the lava into bouncy goo lava, but then it changes back, so you gotta, you know, do your bouncing quickly. And I think the boss was Mole Knight in that one. I believe that was the last stage that I did. So I'm not exactly sure how far I am, but, you know, I feel like I'm far enough that I can talk a little bit about the game. It is a very excellent game. You know, at first I was a little frustrated with it. I'm a pretty easily frustrated gamer. But the more you play it, I don't know, you just practice, 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 you get very good, and it's extremely satisfying the more you play it, and it's satisfying, rewarding, and there's no shortage of things to do, surprisingly. I mean, there's only, you know, a limited amount of stages, but sometimes, like, extra characters will pop up on the map, and you can go and just battle them. It's not even part of a stage, you just, you know, hear their story through text, actually, and fight them. And, yeah, there's that. There's, like, upgrading your equipment. There's upgrading your health bar. Collecting tons of treasure is very important, hence the fact that I've gone back to previous levels multiple times. It's a very, very excellent platformer. One thing that has struck me about this game is the graphics, though. They're incredible.
Yeah,
I mean,
nice.
They're just, like, NES graphics on steroids, basically, is how I would describe them. But you just gotta experience them for yourself. They're so striking. You feel like you're just part of this living, breathing, beautiful world. And, you know, there's actually quite a few characters to interact with. There's a village that you unlock right near the beginning. There's also a smaller village, kind of an armorer village that you unlock a little later on. So there's a surprising amount of characters, and then there's just characters that you meet on the road, I guess, who you fight, and there's a whole lot of dialogue. The characters are all very, they're surprisingly fleshed out and have a lot of personality. And so the game just has like abundant charm and the graphics. You just have to play this game and experience these graphics.
Yeah, no, it is really cool how it is like a an NES game, but yeah, yes, on steroids. Because yeah, it does use that kind of that theme, but it's doing a lot more technical stuff than an original Nintendo game could, and it is cool to see that approach. So it's like, what if the Nintendo did have like a bolt-on peripheral to give it some extra juice? What sort of things they could have got out of the system? But yeah, it's an absolutely gorgeous game, and yeah, we obviously shouldn't forget obviously the music.
Ah, how could I forget? I've just said enough about the soundtrack. Just go get it already. There's not much more I can say about the soundtrack. I listened to the whole soundtrack multiple times before I really started playing the game. It just never gets old somehow. I mean, it's like I say, I have a handful of favorites from the soundtrack that I've listened to multiple times. And even as I start playing this game and hearing those tunes again, over and over and over again, I never get old, or they never get old. I don't know how that is, but it's such a good soundtrack. So overall, you need to get this game and you need to play it, sooner rather than later. I kind of waited on this one. I waited to buy it, and then even after I bought it, I waited to play it. But I'm actually very grateful for this question from Steve that, got me playing this fantastic game. So it's very good. It's also, I don't know, the pacing is very well done in this game. It's like I mentioned before, there's a lot of things that you can do if you're bored of, or if you're a little, because when I get frustrated with a game, my heart's like pounding and I'm a little overexcited, and so I kind of need to do something to relax. There's always something to do to relax. You can go to a previous stage that you're like a pro at and earn a ton more money, and then you can go to the village, and it's just a very excellent game that will keep you engaged for sure. Sometimes when I play games that I feel like I have to play, I am not that interested in them, unfortunately. That's actually a little bit how I feel with Bravely Default, but that's kind of another story. But this game, I mean, I kind of at first I felt like, oh, I have to play this so I can talk about it on Unfindo Radio, but I have just been enjoying the heck out of it. So, yeah, I think enough said on that subject. Thank you, Mike McSurdy, Mike Fulham, and Steve for the questions. We really love answering your questions, and I'm particularly appreciative of Steve's question for, getting me playing Shovel Knight. So that basically brings us to the end of the show. If you have any questions or comments, you can always send them to us in an email at contact@infendo.com. You can also leave a comment on the site, just about on any post, and we'll see it and respond to it on the show, hopefully. But thank you very much for listening. And this has been Infendo Radio.
See you later.
Bye, guys.